I'm Matt Duss. I'm a policy analyst at the Center for American Progress. This is Foreign Entanglements. With me today is Youssef Munayyer. Sorry, he is the director of the Palestine Center. I always mix that up. Is it the Palestine Center or the Jerusalem Fund, right?
Yeah, it's the Jerusalem Fund. The Palestine Center is our policy program.
That's right. I'm sorry. But a great analyst of Middle East affairs and specifically on the Israeli-Palestinian situation. Great to be here with you today, Youssef.
Thanks for having me again, Matt.
We've seen, quite a bit of activity over the past few months, actually going almost a year now since John Kerry took office as the Secretary of State. He's made the Israeli-Palestinian talks or restarting those talks or trying to move that process along a priority. He's committed a great deal of time and energy to it. He's traveled to the region, I think, about 10 times now. He may be up to 11, I'm not sure. There's a number of different issues I want to address here. I mean, first, I'd just love to hear your take, kind of a 30,000 foot. Do you notice any difference to the way Kerry is going about this than the way U.S. secretaries of state or administrations have gone about this over the past couple decades?
Well, nobody can accuse John Kerry of not putting in the time or giving this issue the attention that a secretary of state can or should. Certainly, as you've mentioned, he's made many trips over to the region in the past several months. He spent lots of time there. When it comes to, sort of U.S. interests, one has to even start wondering about, the amount of time he's spending on that issue when you have other serious issues as well throughout mm-hmm. the region. You have a destabilizing, war in Syria. You've got the mm-hmm. Iranian issue. Of course, the Palestinian issue is very, very important. But given all the other dynamics in the region, the fact that he spent so much time on this issue, I think speaks to a degree of commitment that he has that is unique, at least in recent memory, for U.S. interlocutors in this issue. That being said, it's not really only about the amount of time you spend, but how you handle the role of mediator. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, when it comes to that, I don't think he has been that much different than many of his predecessors, has not given us much more reason for hope. Mm-hmm. He seems to be, willing to stick it out, even though he may know very well that the chances are far less than likely of being able to move the parties in any positive direction, particularly the Israelis. Mm-hmm. But he's been, willing to kind of, play the game to get to a stage where, he seems to be hoping that he can put, difficult questions before the parties and then have them, try to deal with it. The problem is, when we get to that point, what sort of role is the United States going to play if the stronger party, the Israelis, decide to, continue to pursue a maximalist position? Right. Are they going to press the Israelis? And there's been no indication that they're really prepared to do that to the extent necessary to get anything close to a acceptable compromise on the core issues. We have reports now about John Kerry accepting this, Israeli demand for recognition of a Jewish state in the so-called framework agreement that he's, working on now. The Israelis are even objecting to any mention of Jerusalem at all, in such an agreement. The refugee issue is for them something that, they would not even consider part of the discussion. While he spent lots of time, there, he's got very little to show for it. I've been a skeptic about this for a long time, but I think there's plenty of reasons for that, given, you know, the positions the parties have taken and the U.S.'s historic role in not being able to do anything to really change Israeli behavior on this.
Yeah, I want to come back to the Jewish state question. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, I mean, we should stipulate that, you know, these are rumors. Sometimes rumors turn out to be true. Sometimes they don't. But these are unconfirmed reports that Secretary Kerry will include some mention of that in the framework. My kind of presumption has been for a while that in some final agreement would contain some language of, you know, a recognition of Israel's Jewish character and an Israeli recognition of the Nakba, if not an admission of, you know, culpability. But it seems, you know, Netanyahu has clearly made this, you know, he's elevated this to a kind of a central, you know, obsession, if I can use that word. I think I can. And there's actually been a number of really good articles, I think. You know, some I agree with, some I disagree with. Over the past few days about this question, just a couple of, I mean, one was by Bernard Avishai in The New Yorker, who is very skeptical, who had a number of reasons why it really doesn't make any sense to make this demand of the Palestinians. Another one by Noam Shazaf in 972 magazine, who is an Israeli progressive, who really, really slammed Kerry based on these reports. You know, it's basically saying, listen, if Kerry makes this part of the framework agreement, it is now, I mean, this is now, basically this is the new benchmark beyond which any Israeli prime minister cannot go. I mean, he's essentially building it into the process. Ziad Asali of the American Task Force on Palestine had what I thought was a pretty good piece in Haaretz this morning, you know, just again saying, I mean, what do you even mean when you say Jewish state, and why should you expect, if you don't even know what that means, why should you expect the Palestinians to acknowledge it and affirm it? And then Liel Leibovitz in Tablet had a piece defending it and essentially saying that, you know, it's necessary for an end of claims agreement, which I just don't get that. I'm gonna assume that you're skeptical of this as well, but here's what I don't get. If you have a final end of claims agreement where all the borders are drawn, why does a recognition of Israel as a Jewish state matter? I mean, I guess I'm asking you to explain the Israeli justification, but
right.
You
well,
know,
I,
so,
we, you know, you're asking that question, departing from the assumption that you know, it's about getting that recognition is about getting a, you know, lasting agreement, but it's actually
I'm assuming it's in good faith, which you're
right.
saying is my mistake.
No, absolutely not. And I think if you it's not in good faith, and if you you know, sort of look at the history of it, the problem here is not just this specific issue of recognition of a Jewish state. But the way in which an issue like this, which did not exist as an issue in these conversations 10 years ago, has become amplified by one side, the Israeli side, so much so through the mobilization of public opinion, that Netanyahu can argue now to, you know, the mediator here that, you know, he can argue, I have to have this. This is critical for my, you know, for my constituency. I have to deliver on this. It's a must. Now, you know, the problem here is not about just the fact that it's a recognition of a Jewish state, but the fact that only the Israelis can do that. The Palestinians are in this process don't have the leverage to move goalposts over time. Only the Israelis do, and here's where the role of the mediator is so important. If we're gonna actually expect a successful outcome here, the mediator's role has to do something to create balance in this, you know, power relationship that's really asymmetrical between the Israelis and Palestinians, or else you're just going to see, you know, this over and over and over again. 10 years ago, this did not exist as a demand. Today it does.
What?
10 years ago, the Jewish state thing did not exist as a demand from the Israelis. Today it does. Maybe 5 years down the line, there will be another issue that did not exist today that becomes a key demand of the Israelis that just moves the goalposts further and further right from further and further away from a Palestinian minimum. So for me, it's, you know, I mean, this issue, there are plenty of problems with it on its own, on its face. And a lot of people who have written about it have pointed out some of those problems. But I think it speaks to a larger issue about how Israel is able to really throw its weight around in these negotiations to maximize their leverage. And that is, you know, a recurring theme, whether it's with the Jewish state issue or many other issues in the past. And now we're starting to see the same sort of thing with this question of a long-term, and I love the way this is phrased, the long-term military presence in the Jordan Valley, which is exactly what it is continued occupation. And that now is being pushed by Israeli leaders as a, you know, as a minimum necessary demand to satisfy their home front.
Right. And in a situation that we've seen recur over and over during Netanyahu's tenure, you've got his own like security experts saying that, you know, we don't need this. Meir Dagan coming out again a couple weeks ago saying the Jordan Valley demand makes little sense.
Right, and you know, it's if you kind of look at Netanyahu in particular, you know, separately from other Israeli leaders, he has these. Particularly in the last 10 years, he's had these three different sort of go-to excuses that he uses in a revolving nature. Anytime there's any sort of U.S. commitment to a process in any sustained way, like we're seeing now from Kerry, we saw the same sort of thing in 2010, 2011, when there was the entire question of the settlement freeze that wasn't, and so on, and Biden's visit to Jerusalem. The Israeli Prime Minister's three go-to items are incitement, security, and this Jewish state question, which is always, you know, used to create another hurdle that, you know, he knows that the Palestinians
simply cannot John Hilsenrath, the December jobs report.
Sorry.
Put a big chill on.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just saying that these essentially function as excuses to delay the process and delay any outcome. And it's, you know, it's typical of what we've seen from Netanyahu in the past. And, you know, he's actually on video admitting that this is his, you know, philosophy with how to deal with peace talks.
Right. The famous video, what was it, from the early 2000s, right?
It was from 2000, where he's speaking to, Israeli voters, happened to be in a settlement about how he essentially torpedoed the Oslo Accords by, saying that, Israel, you know, had to have certain security demands met, and that Israel and only Israel would define what, meeting those demands were. And so, in effect, it can continue to say that, you know, its security demands are not being met, and so no movement on the implementation of these agreements. Look, you have to expect the Israelis to want to get the maximum that they can. That's just the natural sort of course of things. But you also need to demand that the mediator in this position, which is the United States, play a balanced role, and they're not. That's where the problem is.
So let me step back. You mentioned a few issues that Netanyahu has always referred to. Incitement is one of them. I think one of the issues with incitement is that when you look over the roadmap commitments of the Palestinians and the Israelis, the Palestinians have largely met their commitments, certainly on security. in the West Bank. I mean, anyone you talk to, Israeli Americans, they all acknowledge that the PA has done enormous work in terms of security in the West Bank. Incitement, even there was a Washington Institute for Near East Policy report a couple of years ago that even noted that, you know, great improvement has gone on the question of incitement, but it still does exist. I would you agree?
Look, there was a trilateral commission set up mm-hmm. to deal with the issue of incitement. And the reason right. that this came to be was because the Israelis were saying, well, you know, the Palestinians teach their children this and that, and the Palestinians were saying, well, you know, that happens on your side too. And so it really, you know, makes the discussion devolve into, you know, a sort of, you know, look how mean you are type of thing, which is really not, you know, conducive to solving major, you know, geostrategic and diplomatic issues. So there was this trilateral commission set up where the Americans had a role as well, and both sides could bring their claims about, the
incitement,
the mean things that the other side was saying to this commission, and the Israelis have rejected participation in this commission for years now, and have used, you know, these claims of incitement only to, you know, point a finger of blame at the Palestinians anytime there is movement on, you know, the question of the peace process. So, you know, it just serves as a distraction from what is really the problem here. You know, I often tell people that that they need to remember that it is Israel that is occupying Palestinian territory, not the other way around. And if we're talking about a territorial agreement, that reality is the first and foremost one that we have to deal with, not the mean things that are said by, you know, either side, because those are largely a product of the realities on the ground. And so it ultimately is just another one of these distractions.
I don't know. On the one hand, yes. I mean, certainly, I mean, my point about bringing up the roadmap commitments and how the Palestinians have met theirs was a point of saying, I mean, this is one of the reasons the Israelis focus so much on incitement, because they can't focus on security or the other things that the Palestinians, you know, the very significant steps that the Palestinians have done, the hoops that they've jumped through to meet their commitments. And here's this one where the Israelis can continue to point to and say, oh, see, they're not doing this. So there's definitely that part of elevating incitement to make this huge deal about it. But at the same time, you know, I mean, I was looking at this presentation that Yossi Cooperwasser, he's the I think he's a strategic affairs minister in Israel. This new presentation, there was a copy of it in the New York Times. You know, some of it is nonsense. I mean, listen, I mean, you know, some of it is like, you know, Palestinian books that don't note the green line. Listen, you can go to Ben Gurion Airport and find Israeli Tourism Ministry maps that do not have the green line. So if you're gonna call that incitement, well, exactly. But I mean, some of the examples were genuinely ugly. Stuff appearing on Palestinian state television. I mean, I'm not asking you to apologize or explain it or anything. Sure, it's a product in part of the situation. I think everyone needs to recognize that. But I don't think it's unreasonable for the Israelis or the Americans to ask that this stuff not appear on Palestinian official television and Palestinian official media.
Well, look, I think these sorts of claims need to be, you know, analyzed for what they are. And anyone looking at that presentation, and I know exactly what presentation you're talking about, you know, needs to look at it objectively and ask, is this in fact a fair representation of what it claims to be, which is of the Palestinian discourse and Palestinian media? When you look at the methodology, behind it, it's nothing like that at all. In fact, the most egregious examples, some of them very outdated, are cherry picked to present a predetermined conclusion. And some of the more rigorous and academic studies of discourse on both sides have come to completely different conclusions. And so that's why it's necessary to have a objective mechanism wherein, if we are to treat this question of, you know, incitement on both sides seriously, That mechanism needs to be used and respected. And the fact that the Israelis simply do not want to use that mechanism at all shows you that, you know, their interest here is not in genuinely resolving this issue of incitement, but rather using it to you know, to point the finger at Palestinians, particularly in, you know, an American, you know, an American public opinion. The question of incitement is far less presented in, you know, even Israeli discourse than it is in American discourse. That article that you were talking about was a major article in the New York Times, not in, you know, Haaretz or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's meant to create the impression in the American public discourse that it is the Palestinians that don't want peace, when in reality, it is only the Israelis that are building on Palestinian territory, not the other way around. Mm. And this is, you know, we're talking about a two-state framework fundamentally about territorial issues. So, you know, again, if these claims are going to be made, fine. Look at them objectively, question them seriously, and if they don't stand up to scrutiny, then we need to dismiss them and move on.
Mm-hmm. So getting back to the security question, you and I had an exchange on Twitter about when General Allen, this is General Allen, the former Marine general who was the commander of NATO forces most recently in Afghanistan, and he was tasked by the Obama administration to carry out an assessment, the deepest one ever done by an American administration, an assessment of Israel's security needs. He came on, I think, in this last summer, and worked for a few months, talked, had deep consultations with the Israelis. And this is almost exclusively with the Israelis. It's not like he was there to coordinate between Israelis and Palestinians. He was there to talk to the Israelis and get a sense of what they felt that they really needed in terms of security requirements in any two-state resolution. So he and Kerry have presented these assessments to Israeli leaders and to the Palestinians. And sure, I don't think we should be surprised. And again, as I said before, all this stuff is being kept very quiet. So we're relying on rumor and unconfirmed reports of what was in it and what has been said about it. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I understand your skepticism. You know, and I am, you know, I have my own skepticism based on the way the U.S. has historically dealt with this. There have been a lot of examples of, you know, the Israelis lay out their security red lines and then the Americans put it on U.S. letterhead and they present it to the Palestinians. And I think, you know, that's a problem. But I think, you know, if the goal here is to present both leaders with a genuine choice, a yes or no option of moving forward, it seems to me that it's a smart play to really try to take the security issue off the table as much as possible. And by that, I mean, you know, Netanyahu's, it's like his mantra, security, security, security. And any time, you know, he's presented with difficult choices, he always kind of falls back on, oh, well, you just don't understand our security needs here. We're in a very dangerous neighborhood. It's like, you've heard it, I've heard it. It's a constant thing. Well, now Kerry can say, well, as a matter of fact, I do understand because this retired general to my left here has, you know, he talked to everybody here and did the deepest assessment that we've ever done. So we do understand what you think your needs are. So I think it was just a way of kind of leveling, to the extent possible, leveling the ground here in these kinds of discussions. So I guess the next question is, to what extent are all of these concerns taken on board? And I think in the weeks since you and I had that brief exchange, you know, from what we've seen, I think the whole Jordan Valley thing in particular is a real problem. I mean, the idea that you would have that, you know, any Palestinian leader could accept Israeli forces on its border with Jordan for 10 years, I think is a fantasy. Is that fair to say?
Well, yeah, and I mean, it's not just that. I mean, you know, the Israelis are talking about a long-term presence there. What does that even mean? How can you have a sovereign and independent state when you have foreign troops stationed there? You don't have control over your borders. And we're already talking about a state that would be demilitarized, which means it would not have the ability to defend itself, would likely not have complete control over its borders, would likely not have complete control or any control over its airspace. So, I mean, what we're talking about here is really a state that would be under, you know, glorified occupation, if anything.
So are you saying that even in the best case scenario, you think it would just be a glorified occupation?
Absolutely. In the best case scenario that's been discussed, and let's be clear about what that is. The best case scenario that has been discussed, as sort of, you know, the conventional mainstream of what could be accepted by both sides, would be, you know, a swap in territory, that keeps major Israeli settlement blocks in Israeli control, a demilitarized Palestinian state, a Israeli presence, to some extent on the, border with Jordan, no Palestinian, control over its airspace and so on. That's not an independent state. That is glorified occupation, is exactly what it is. And, you know, there's really no two ways about it. And that's the best case scenario. So, I mean, you know, it's not a very attractive offer for Palestinians. Especially as an end of claims, agreement to say, well, you know, give up all your claims and everything that you've been demanding throughout, the history of this issue, so that you can have a demilitarized state that has, you know, really no sovereignty and is, you know, ultimately going to be subservient to, you know, its overpowering neighbor Israel. But that's, you know, that's what it ends up being. But the bigger question here about the security thing is who defines what our security needs? If we keep letting the Israelis define exclusively what are the security needs, not only for the Israelis, but also for the Palestinians, then you're going to have them again abusing that, privilege to maximize their, position. And the Jordan Valley is just, you know, one example of it. The other day you had a statement from Netanyahu saying that, you know, there's no way that they'd evacuate their positions in Hebron and in Beit Il, which are settlements deep inside the West Bank, in any final agreement. I mean, so what are we, what are we really talking about here?
Yeah.
How different is that, you know, outcome from what we really have today? Right. It's not an independent state at all.
So what do you think, I mean, in your view, what is the best option here? I mean, what is the PLO's option here? Say Mahmoud Abbas agrees with everything you just said. What's the next step?
Well, I don't think they really have long-term strategic planning. That's unfortunately one of the major problems, that they're dealing with. The only other alternative that they've talked about in any serious way is going back to this international approach of appealing to, you know, international forums and institutions for recognition and so on. But that doesn't change the reality on the ground. There is no serious strategic thinking about ways to amplify leverage. At most it's been symbolic, and been used in ways to kind of nudge the United States' position on the peace process over the past, you know, 6 years of Obama's time in office. Whatever's next for the Palestinians does not seem likely to be something that is initiated by, the PLO or the PA leadership. In large part because they're so dependent on, Western donor dollars, and particularly the support of the United States, and of course Israel.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is, I mean, let me just repeat the question. I mean, if you were the president, I mean, what would you just go, you know, full force into this international strategy?
I think you'd have to have a major moment of reevaluation about strategy. Their strategy has been negotiations, at all costs, and that has proved fruitless. It has only proved to be useful for the Israelis. There needs to be a total rethinking of their strategy, and one that moves away from U.S.-mediated negotiations. And that's going to involve some serious thinking about, Palestinian leadership, Palestinian representation, how you maintain the well-being of a Palestinian population, and their, national interests, while at the same time being so dependent and subservient to U.S. and Israeli whims. It's very much a catch-22 for Palestinian leaders in Ramallah, but it's a catch-22 that they've played a large role of putting themselves in.
Right. Yeah, I guess I'm not – I mean, I agree with you on a lot of, what we're talking about. In a way, it's a very unique situation, the two-state, for the Palestinian state that we are talking about. It's difficult, if not impossible, to think of any other similar states. Or, we often hear from – whenever the Israelis want to bomb Gaza, we always hear like, what country in the world would ever put up with rockets coming out? But I think you can reverse that and say, what country in the world would ever put up with, a foreign army on its border, that it shares with another country? Or what country in the world would put up with another country creating colonies on its land? But when I look, practically, trying to look at what creates the best future for the Palestinians, it's very hard for me to imagine saying no to, if we're going to look at, the two-state, a Palestinian state as it's been described, and I agree with you, there are a lot of shortcomings, there's a lot about it that's not great. But, in terms of expressing, Palestinian nationhood, preserving Palestinian culture, securing Palestinian sovereignty and security, sovereignty just being kind of a tool for security. I wouldn't say I'm as negative about that possibility. But I think one of the things that brings me to that conclusion too is just that the other option is just years and years and decades more of dispossession and difficulty. And who am I to sit here in the United States and say to a Palestinian living in Nablus or Ramallah or Jenin or Lebanon or anywhere else that, this is probably the best deal you're going to get right now. But that's kind of how I feel. And I want to say that as respectfully and humbly as possible. I just don't see a better option.
Look, given the realities of power and Palestinians are not, they're not blind to those realities. They know exactly what they're up against. I can't tell you how many images I've seen of 5-year-old children in the streets of Gaza or the West Bank, confronting Israeli tanks with rocks in their hands. They are acutely aware of the power imbalance here and what that means. At the same time, they're also aware of what making compromises for the sake of making compromises has actually meant. And what they've seen is that any time that they do that, they're not rewarded with any serious proposals for their basic human rights. The stronger power, which is the Israelis in this situation, continues to demand and ask for more and take more land and entrench its occupation and so on. We could say to the Palestinians, look, realistically, what other option do you have than negotiation? But at the same time, the Palestinians can say, well, what exactly has negotiation provided for us? It's not a position of strength to be in, certainly. But Palestinians have learned a very costly lesson exactly what's involved when you compromise for anything less than what is, your basic human rights, and your basic, demands. And I think that more and more Palestinians are moving to realize that doing that was such a big mistake. And there is a sort of rethinking going on in the broader Palestinian discussion about how to re-strategize and how to learn from the mistakes that have been made by some people in leadership and in the past, and where that sort of left the Palestinians today.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Youssef. I guess we'll have to hold off for now in presenting our Das Munayyer plan for solving the Arab-Israeli conflict. Maybe sometime in the future. But interesting, as always, to talk with you, and I will see you around, okay?
Indeed. Thank you, Matt.
All right. Thanks, Youssef. Bye-bye.
Take care.